I'm Shalina Tobin, and my guest today is one of London's most talented up-and-coming chefs. If you've got the planning skills to book a table 3 to 4 months in advance, you'll have the privilege of sharing the most extraordinary experience with just 7 other diners. As head chef of Owlis in the heart of buzzing Soho in London, Brighton-born Charlie Taylor surprises and delights us with his culinary skills. Welcome, Charlie. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. Yeah, good, good. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for coming on. I'm glad we finally got it together.
yeah. Second time.
Yeah. So you've had a few weeks off, have you?
Yes, yeah. Restaurant Owlis in Soho, currently going for a bit of a refurb. Uh-huh. So tidying the place up a bit. So exciting. So a couple of weeks off. Just came back from Scotland, wandered around Scotland for best part of a week, ate in lots of great restaurants and drank a lot of great whiskey, and then did a bit of a sort of self-tour around the Isle of Skye. It's just stunning around there. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Lucked out with the weather, actually got a bit of sunburn, which I wasn't expecting to happen in Scotland.
Yeah.
But yeah, great to get out of the city. And then just cramming in lots of restaurants, doing my homework, eating as much as possible. Because most good or great restaurants in London are closed Sunday and Monday, like we are at Owlis. So it's very hard for me to get away and get reservations in these places that I've always wanted to go to. So yeah, making the most of it. So hitting all the top hitters at the moment. So
tell us what your favourite place is that you've been to recently.
Definitely last night, Kitchen Table, 100%. Yeah, stunning food, beautiful setting. James and his team, great. Just yeah. Everything they're doing, yeah. Still sort of processing it now, I think. Just sort of can't quite believe how amazing it was, to be honest.
Yeah, you're very lucky to have gone, because it's so impossible to get a table there at the moment.
Yeah.
We've been waiting for him to open for such a long time, and now finally it's just impossible to get a seat. But hopefully soon, I'll definitely be having the same experience as you did. You mentioned the refurb at Owlis. So are you involved in that process?
We've got a whole new restaurant design coming in to sort of start from scratch, pretty much. So the concept's staying the same, in terms of we're only going to cook for 8 people an evening, and it'll be a long 15, 16 course tasting menu. It's just sort of sharpening up the decor inside, change the lighting, acoustics, music, all those sort of things that as a chef, you don't really understand. I mean, we can cook and run a business, but to sort of design a restaurant is sort of far beyond us. So we got a proper restaurant designer in to do it properly. So yeah, no, looking forward to it. I think there's going to be like spotlights on every position on the table, so that sort of like illuminated food a bit more.
Yeah.
A bit more storage space for us, because the space is tiny, right? It is probably one of the smallest restaurants in London, I think.
I think probably, definitely one of the smallest I've been to.
If not in terms of how many covers we do, like 8 people, and definitely in terms of size, I think it's just very compact. It's like playing Tetris every day, making sure everything fits in the fridge and the dry stores and all that kind of stuff, but keeping organized and on top of that. So yeah, a bit more storage space with the refurb is happening. So yeah, looking forward to going back after 2 weeks off into a brand new restaurant effectively. So it's exciting stuff.
Well, I look forward to coming back, and, you know, although it's an 8 cover restaurant and it's small, it is phenomenal. And I think that the size of it adds to the whole experience. It makes it so intimate. And, you know, we're literally just, you know, it is perfect chef's table. We're one-on-one with you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think I think what sets us apart from most other restaurants that have chef tables inside is, you know, typically it's a table that might be a bit closer to the kitchen or even in the kitchen, and then you get a chef come over and explain one or two dishes, which is, you know, it's great. That's what a chef's table should be, and you can see all the action. But I think the difference with us at Owlis, we haven't got another restaurant of 40 or 50 people to cook for as well, right? So 100% of our attention, our time is just dedicated to cooking for 8 people. So myself, Nico, my chef de partie, my Italian guy, he's you know, he's great, solid cook. And then Simona, front of house, cooks, looking after all the wine for us. So it's just a team of 3 of us looking after 8 people. It's good, nice sort of communication between guests and chef, which you don't really normally get, I think, in restaurants. Typically, you know, in a busy restaurant, when you're sort of in a kitchen back of house and that sort of response you get from the customers, it would normally be your waiter being like, oh, table four, they loved it. And it's like, okay, cool. But like to actually put dishes in front of people,
and the room
goes quiet and you hear like ums and ahs and people saying wow and stuff. That's like instant satisfaction, instant recognition, like from food you're serving to the guests, which is great, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And watching you guys work as a team, like you said, there's just three of you there, and you guys, you know, between the three of you, it is flawless. Everything, you know, between the service, the, you know, plating up, and even, you know, the washing up, it's all three of you are kind of working together. And wow, what an experience. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, it's good. Good. It's quite tight knit as well. I think it will get worse. It will sort of dilute it if we did more covers or if we had more people working there as well. It's almost harder when there's four guys and they're working. We've not worked together for a long time. The team, myself and the rest of my team, been there about 8-9 months now. But we just work so well together. It's just, yeah, it's so easy. So such a nice flow. We understand how each other work now. So might be a bit of sort of relearning the flow of service when after the refurb to see how that affects things and changes things, but I'm sure we'll sort of iron out those creases pretty soon.
So. Yeah, absolutely. So Charlie, tell us about your childhood and, you know, where you grew up, how you developed your interest in food.
So it's something I've always wanted to do. So I'm from Brighton originally, South Coast. Started working in restaurants from pretty young age, 14. But I think sort of prior to that, there's stories of my mum saying, like, at New Year's Eve parties or Christmas parties when you have lots of family around and all that kind of stuff, from the age of like five, I'll be wandering around and giving people, I don't know, Twiglets or like topping people's drinks up and stuff like that. And I just, like, for some reason there's always a bit sort of like a bit hospitable in me, like always wanted to sort of I don't know, feed people and make sure I have people with drinks and all that kind of stuff. And it just kind of stemmed from that, I guess. No one in my family is a chef. I mean, they all can cook. They're all good cooks, but none of them are chefs. And then, started working in restaurants when I was 14, just washing up the pots and pans because I knew I wanted to be a chef. So I wanted to sort of work my way from the bottom and work my way up the hierarchy, up a ladder in the kitchen. So I remember I used to wash the pots and pans as quickly as I could, just so I could peel a carrot or peel a potato or something like that. And then sort of slowly worked my way up the ladder in Brighton.
I was going to ask if so that kitchen, your first entry was actually a kitchen porter. I wasn't sure if you actually applied for that position or it just kind of just happened that way. Amazing.
I just wanted to get my foot in the door and sort of prove that, you know, obviously 14 years old, they're not gonna trust me to pick up a knife. I was still at school or sort of smashing out the pans. So I literally used to put my chef jacket in my school bag and walk from school to the restaurant, or work at the weekends. We'd like do double shifts at the weekends and stuff. So yeah, it was pretty full on. But when you're sort of young and you sort of want to learn and work your way up the ladder, then you sort of crack on and get your head down. And just sort of a bit different to most people's sort of teenage years and childhoods, I think. But it was, if I didn't do that, then I wouldn't be where I am now, sort of thing, right? So it's
So you did start pretty young. So you mentioned your education. So you did a national diploma in hospitality and catering before that, right?
Yeah. So I quickly realised I probably learned more in a professional kitchen than I did in like a learning space, a culinary school or diploma or anything like that. So I kind of did this sort of part-time course. It was one day a week. And it was a bit more business background, which is sort of, at the time I didn't think it made much sense and I was a bit unsure why I was learning this. I was only doing an hour in a kitchen a day and stuff like that in this culinary school for this course. And I was just like a bit confused about why I was sort of learning about numbers and all the business side of stuff. And I was just like, at that time, I just like wanted to cook, wanted to get into the kitchen, get my head down and sort of, you know, hone my skills as quickly as possible. And now sort of looking back at it now, you know, I'm head chef and sort of looking at the numbers is quite a big part of my job now to make sure, you know, the business makes money. So to have that sort of background knowledge and it's all sort of coming back to me, it's actually, pretty useful, even though I thought it wouldn't be. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So how much of the business do you, I mean, you just mentioned the numbers side of things. How much of it actually are you involved with? So, you know, are you involved with the ordering and, you know, and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, 100% ordering. Pretty much sort of free rein on the menu. Obviously, I've got Ollie and Simon above me. Ollie, work with Ollie very closely to sort of hone in the dishes to make sure the dishes are just right. And then obviously the way we set up our list as well, it's sort of one price for the food. So we just got to, you know, get the best ingredients that we can possible, whether it's from the farm or from our local suppliers, and, you know, make sure we use them in the right time of the season, because it can get very expensive outside of the season.
Yeah,
just to sort of make sure with business is running smoothly, just focusing on the food as well. So
yeah, okay, well, I sort of like jumped ahead though. We were just talking about your history. So you moved on, so from your kitchen, you started as a kitchen porter, and that was an oblong restaurant.
Oblong, yeah. Which I don't think is no longer there now, but it's in, yeah, quite a little restaurant in Hove. I think I did about 2 years there, and then I was obviously at the age of 16, you kind of want to get a big name on your belt. And Jamie Oliver just opened a restaurant in Brighton in town. I think I was, my first day was the first day of the restaurant opening. I was like,
yeah, oh, wow.
I'm a chef, Jamie Oliver. I thought it was great back then. But even at that age, I think I was on £6.50 an hour. And I thought that was sort of loads of money. I was well happy with that. Which I guess is, yeah, still not too bad considering I was living at home and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you're still a teenager, right? So, I mean, really are you, you know, going out on holidays?
When you're doing 50, 60 hours a week as well, it racks up for sure.
Yeah.
And then, so I only did about 6 months then because I actually got headhunted with the head chef of a restaurant called Seven Dials in Brighton, which was at the time one of the best restaurants. I had two rosettes. Again, no longer there, the food chains. Food scene in Brighton has changed completely since when I lived there. I spent about 2 years at this restaurant called Seven Dials. Sort of a bigger kitchen, a lot more fast paced, but just sort of really started to sort of learn the skills, you know, get on the sort of like meat section, start cooking the meat and sauces and stuff at the age of, you know, 17, 18.
Brilliant.
Then I quickly realized there was this thing called a Michelin star and sort of wanted to work my way up and progress even further.
This was the point where you thought, okay, I want to, first it was the chef you were going for, and now it's the stars that you want to cook that level of standard to.
At that time, yeah, I think I realized like the standard of food that I was working at was good, but I knew I wanted to do better. I knew I could do better. And just happened to be that Michelin star restaurant sort of creates that environment for you to learn and sort of progress in that way. Right. So,
yeah.
I was living in Brighton and then got a job at the Pass in South Lodge Hotel under Chef Matt Gillen. So at the time had one star, three rosettes. So I think I was part of the team that won the fourth rosette there. And then I was there for about 2 years, sort of leaving in a relatively sort of senior role, started sort of junior as possible. But Matt was a great guy to work for, and that was sort of not a million miles away from the Owlis sort of style of restaurant, sort of looking back at it. So it's called The Pass because it's, I think it was 22 cover restaurant at the time. I think it's a bit bigger now, but those seats are all in the kitchen pretty much. And even with the guys with their back to the kitchen, there'll be like different CCTV footage camera angles in the wall off the kitchen. So you could people, and all the chefs would go and explain their dishes to the customers as well. So that was a sort of really nice introduction, especially at that age, you know, still learning how to cook effectively.
And this is where you learned molecular cooking as well, right?
Yeah, he was quite big on that. Yeah. Not entirely. I mean, he's got quite a classical background himself. He's from one of the original Midsummer guys, mm-hmm. Under Daniel Clifford. So yeah, still sort of very, you know, classical heart of everything. But yeah, definitely sort of venturing into sort of the molecular style and a few of the chemicals and all that kind of stuff. So it's cool to sort of get a bit of a knowledge and understanding about how that works as well. It was just cool to sort of interact with guests at sort of that time as well. And I felt like that was quite a new thing in this country for chefs to, you know, be seen and be shown and to interact with guests. In places like Japan, obviously it's been happening for a long time, right? But it's like omakase style restaurants, and they've, you know, people have been sitting in front of chefs for hundreds of years in other countries, but it's relatively new here, I think. But it's cool, it's hitting off. You see a lot more chef's table sort of popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
So after my little stint with Matt, wanted to move to London. So after sort of pretty much getting to like senior chef de partie sort of role at the pass, found myself a job at Alan Williams at the Westbury. But again, I wanted to start from scratch. I wanted to start from the bottom. So I took a commis chef job. And then, yeah, sort of worked my way up and got my head down. It's where I first started working with Tom Bouton. I know you've had a chat with him recently. You've done a podcast with him recently.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so we were both working there together. I was there for about 2 years, I think.
Yeah.
And then, again, wanted to up my game again. So I went to the Ledbury. So spent 2 years at the Ledbury under Brett Graham.
Yeah.
Which was an amazing experience. Great, great produce coming through the door. Very fast-paced kitchen. And obviously working at that two Michelin star level was something I've wanted to do for quite a while, ever since I was started working at the past with Matt. That sort of two star was always sort of something that I wanted to sort of get my head, like get on my CV, get under my belt and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it was just a bit of a blur, to be honest. I think it was, again, 2 years, just under 2 years, shy of 2 years at the Ledbury, but it was a bit of a blur. It happened so quickly. We're doing a lot of hours, cooking for a lot of people, breaking down whole venisons and loads of animals on a day-to-day basis, a fast-paced kitchen. But yeah, I loved it. No, it was a great experience.
Yeah.
And Brett's an amazing guy as well. So.
This was in 2015, right?
I think so, yeah. 14, 15, I think, thereabouts. Yeah.
And how were you working directly with Brett Graham?
Yeah, he was there every day. He was always on the pass. Super passionate guy. Always wanted to make sure he'd be there. I mean, he'd be rotated himself the same as we were all rotated on. So, you know, get his 2 days off like the rest of us because they're open 7 days a week. Mm. And just he was just all over everything. It's such a small kitchen as well. There's, you know, 10, 12 of us running around that small little space. But it was cool space for him to be in charge because he could see everything and sort of nothing sort of got past him, which is why he had the accolades he had, right? And got to, I think it was 10th best restaurant from the San Pellegrino when I was there. Yeah, just an amazing space as well. And obviously then towards the end of me being there, he started his deer park, his Anho deer park farm. So we're getting all of the deer effectively that he was sort of breeding. So that was really cool as well, sort of just see it from sort of start to finish and cook it and serve it. It was a different experience.
Wow. So how were you involved with like the butchery side of things? I mean, were you actually involved in that?
Yeah, 100%. So I started on the garnish section, which I think is probably the most sort of the section where there's a lot of elements, a lot going on. So sort of a bit of a baptism of fire for me, sort of jumping straight on a hot section. I think typically in that kitchen, you start on the cold side and work your way around. And then I did about 10 months on the fish section. So again, we used to get whole fish in and break it down and fillet it and prep it and portion it and all that kind of stuff. And then the last sort of 8-9 months I spent on the sauce section. So it's in a kitchen, the sauce section typically is a guy who breaks down all the animals, cooks all the sauces, all the protein basically. Mm. So yeah, whole venison would come in, obviously like skinned and gutted, and we break it down and use everything from the neck to the bones to the fat to the tendons. Every little bit of the animal was used. I think 1 week I counted, I broke down 17 animals. To sort of give you an idea how busy the place was, yeah, from venisons to hare to lots of different venisons as well, like sika deers and muntjac and all that kind of stuff. It was a busy restaurant.
Yeah, sounds like an amazing, amazing experience. Hmm. So from there, so it was 2 years after that, you went to Japan.
That's so right, yeah.
How did that come about? I mean, you were one of 15 candidates to be selected by the Japanese government amongst thousands of people. Tell us about how the opportunity came about and why you chose Japan.
I was actually going to go to America. That was my plan. So me and Tom, actually, we went to America. We spent a couple of weeks sort of staging and trialing in different restaurants out there. So we both sort of wanted to move out there and work in, you know, the big 2- and 3-star restaurants. So we flew out there. It was actually the time that New York had a snowstorm. So we lost a couple of days pretty much sat inside. But I did a day in 11 Madison Park and Daniel and the Modern in the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, the two-star. They all offered me jobs and it was a great experience. And I was accepted the job at the Modern because I thought it was sort of the food that I wanted to be cooking at that time. And I think sort of organizing, chatting with the HR of that as we came back to London, emailing the HR department and sort of trying to organize my visa and get myself out there. Probably weeks away from getting my visa sorted, and then this sort of opportunity came up to go to Japan. So it was a culinary course, effectively designed by the Japanese government to invite foreign chefs to come to Japan to learn about the traditional culture and cuisine of the country, basically, because obviously Japan was pretty much shut for 1,000 years. They didn't sort of let anyone in or out almost. I think now they really want to sort of promote it as a country. They say 90% of Japanese restaurants outside of Japan are run by, you know, not traditional like Japanese people, like whether they're Chinese or Koreans or just foreign full stop. So they were like, we want to teach foreigners the true Japanese way, like culture and cuisine. So yeah, 15 of us went. So I was the only guy from England to go. We spent 1 month in Tokyo in a Japanese culinary school.
So just rewind a little bit. How were you selected? How did they select you? Did you have to go through some sort of like qualifying process? Did you have to?
Did a couple of Zoom interviews. I know someone who did the original because we were the second year, of course. I know someone who did the original year, the first year. Mm. So yeah, I guess through that sort of connection. And then, yeah, a couple of Zoom interviews and calls and chatting with the guys who run in the program. And then within 3 weeks of hearing about the program, I was on a plane.
Did they take into consideration your sort of your work background, the fact that you were in, you know, hospitality and you'd worked at certain restaurants?
I think so. From the 15 other guys, it was a big mix. So I think I was the main person with like most of the mission star background, but there were some guys that were straight out of CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. Right. There was some guys who just worked in restaurants for a long time. There was a Brazilian guy who was Brazilian Japanese, but he worked in sushi restaurants, so you sort of they invited him over. Just a big mix of people basically. So right. 15 of us effectively all got a huge flat together in Shibuya in Tokyo and spent 1 month in Tokyo in a Japanese language school. So it was about 5-6 hours a day, sort of understanding the basics of Japanese, the language, but sort of very much honed into what we needed to learn. So kitchen Japanese, I called it, right? So all the sort of fruits and vegetables and pots and pans and, you know, faster and all that kind of stuff, knives and getting your way around town and, you know, ordering a couple of beers, all the important stuff, basically. So that was cool. So
spending your whiskey as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then we went to Kyoto. We got the bullet train down to Kyoto and spent 1 month in a Japanese culinary school, which is typically a course designed for about a year, year and a half, I think, for a normal Japanese student. But they condensed it down to about 5 weeks for us.
So it must have been intense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was, you know, 6 days a week. And we did crammed in loads of tests and paper-thin peeling. They call it katsuramuki with daikon, where you basically peel a daikon and it comes out like paper-thin sheet, basically. So lots of different knives. Basically learning how to use a knife again, because the Japanese knives are single-beveled instead of double-beveled. So sort of understanding how that works. And then we did trips out to fish markets and saw like tuna markets happening, auctions, went to a sake brewery, spent a few days on a farm, traditional Japanese like vegetable farm, just sort of trying to get to understand the basics of like everything and how it all comes together into a meal, into a kaiseki style Japanese tasting menu. So then after that month or 5 weeks or so, in Taiwa was the name of the culinary school. We all got split off into different sort of restaurants. Most of them had mission stars. So some of the guys went back to Tokyo. I think 5 or 6 of us stayed in Kyoto. And I was put in a restaurant called Kenobu. So it's a 1 mission star kaiseki restaurant. 4th generation. Been open about 90 years. And that was just an amazing experience. Completely different to Western style kitchens, right? So every fish comes in a polystyrene box, like how we get it in this country, but the polystyrene box was filled with seawater and a pump because all the fish were still alive. Literally harvesting our own rice and getting our own vegetables. Under the restaurant, there was a well, so all the dashes and everything was made from the well water, and it was like super clear, super clean. Hierarchy in the Japanese style kitchen is purely determined on how long you've been working there. So the head chef was a head chef because I think he'd been there for about 37 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just absolutely great. And there was about 35 chefs running around the kitchen. It was a big kitchen. It started life as a bento restaurant, just cooking bentos. And then I think they kind of progressed and made it bigger and made it into a sort of full-blown sort of kaiseki restaurant. So it was amazing sort of service. The service they have in Japan for hospitality is so different to what we have here. Just super personal. Always sort of looking up to the customer physically. Yeah, sort of lots of little tips and tricks. And sort of they have a word, I can never remember what it is, but it pretty much translates to customer is God. So here we say customer is king, right? I think their translation pretty much means customer is God. So it kind of sets apart sort of how, what they think hospitality should be or is. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us, talk us through what kind of, you know, techniques or what your learnings were that you apply to your cooking now.
I think it's almost a classic case of less is more, right? Like I feel a lot of chefs, you know, take quite a long time to realize or learn that it's all about the ingredients, right? And it's quite a conscious thing going to work for Simon Rogan, understanding that he has a farm and that sort of close connection with a farmer and sort of growing our fruits and veg and micro herbs and flowers and all that kind of stuff. And if you get an amazing piece of fish, then why not just serve it as an amazing piece of fish? You don't need to, you know, cure it and marinate it and blow torch it and cook it and chill it and freeze it and do all that kind of stuff to it. You know, if it's delicious, just cook it properly, right? It's I think that's, yeah, I learned a lot about that in Japan, basically, and just sort of trying to keep everything really sharp and clean in terms of appearance and taste and flavors. Just not too murky, not too confused. Like, it's, again, it's the classic less is more. I would think if I could boil everything I learned down in that sort of year in Japan, it would be that pretty much, which is, it was hard to say, but.
and do they keep in touch with you? Do they kind of message you every now and then and find out what
you're doing? Yeah, exactly, yeah. No, yeah, constantly emailing the guys who run the course. So now technically I'm an ambassador of Japanese cuisine, effectively.
Oh, wow.
So was, the whole point of the course was meant to come back and basically sort of impart what I learned and sort of teach other chefs around me, you know, what I learned and to help import more Japanese ingredients. Obviously working for the Simon Rogan Group, we want to keep it as British as possible, but definitely things like sake we've got on the menu, even like some ceramics and stuff that we get from Japan. It's just sort of, again, just trying to hero what comes out of Japan, because everything they do is so different and it's always pristine and it always is the best of the best, right? So it'll be, I've got a Japanese knife, I think it's like 16th generation knife maker, and it's just like that, we don't really have that in this country, right? You don't do what your family has done for generations and sort of carry on their sort of legacy and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, you go off and you get a job and that's your career, right? Like, I don't want to follow in my dad's footsteps. I'm sure my children don't want to follow in my footsteps. Yeah, it's just sort of, but everything they do because of that generation, it's part of your family then. It's like part of your DNA almost. So they just perfect it. So, you know, one guy could have a tempura restaurant, and he's been cooking tempura for about 600 years. And, you know, he understands how to make tempura after that, right? So it's...
Yeah, I think I find the history absolutely amazing. I visited Japan and the food is phenomenal. And you're exactly right. I mean, the generations that fill these spaces, it just gets, you know, the techniques just get passed on. And these people learn from when they're literally, from the moment they start walking, they start learning about cooking. And it comes through in their food. It's, you know, they're so hospitable and their food is just, I don't think we went to one restaurant that we were unhappy with. Came back a few stones heavier, but
yeah, right, yeah, that's always the way, yeah. It's just amazing, yeah.
So after that experience, you came back to London and you were head chef at Alan Williams. Tell us about that.
Initially
head chef role.
Well, yeah, initially came back as sous chef. So Tom was head chef at the Westbury. And then I think it was probably a month or 2 months before I was due back to come back to London. He messaged me and he was like, look, what's your plans when you come back? I need a sous chef. And I was just like, yeah, sure. Yeah, let's do it. So it was so nice to sort of come straight back to London, straight into that role. And then shortly after that, close to a year, I think Tom left, went to the Dorchester where he is now. And then, yeah, Alan gave me that head chef role, which is amazing, right? To sort of be a head chef in a restaurant where it all kind of started for me in London as sort of commis chef, working my way up the ladder. So understanding the kitchen, understanding, like, know how Alan works and how his style of food is. But then also have my sort of knowledge that I've learned in the Ledbury and in Japan to sort of come back and sort of have a little combination of my style of food and his style of food. It was a great sort of year that we had cooking together. It was just great fun. It was obviously a big team, you know, busy restaurant, just sort of cooking great food. Yeah, we were loving it. It was great. And then obviously, you know, things kind of fizzled out all pretty quickly with COVID, which is incredibly frustrating. We felt like we just sort of got into a good stride. Really happy with what we're cooking in the restaurant. I had a great team around me, built myself a whole new team, which I think is very hard at the moment in London, especially now after COVID. But even before then, I think there's always been a struggle to find a solid team or find good chefs sort of around you and stuff. So when you do find that, you always try and keep them as best you can and keep everyone happy. And that old school generation of sort of, you know, being in a not very nice environment in kitchens is definitely died out, or dying out anyway. So it's just nice to sort of be the forefront of that, just sort of creating a good environment for people to work in, and like people work happier when they're happy as well, right? So
yeah.
But then, yeah, obviously COVID happened, shut us down, whole hotel shut down, so it made us all redundant. So it's not like just the restaurant was closed down, the whole hotel. So there was a huge auction a few months ago, selling everything inside the hotel, from all the kitchen equipment to, you know, the TVs and everything. So yeah, the hotel fully shut down, which was a shame. But then also every cloud's got a silver lining, right? I found myself doing a day with Ollie at Owlis, and yeah, managed to sneak myself the head chef job there, luckily. And yeah, no, loving it. It's so different to what chefs experience in restaurants. I think it's so different to running a big team like I was at the Westbury, you know, like 14, 15 chefs there. To go to that where it's just two of us, it's just me and Nico. With a bit of Ollie's guidance, it's amazing. It's so different. It's, as I was saying earlier, it's such a satisfying place to work as a chef. Just sort of having this sort of creative freedom and sparking up conversations about people, because I mean, it's the sort of restaurant you go to if you're a bit of a foodie, right? If you're passionate about food, so instantly when people walk in the door, you've already got something in common. Like you want to have a good time, you want to talk about food, you want to eat great food, right? So it's so nice to sort of bounce off people with that.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned, if we just go back a little bit, I mean, you mentioned COVID and that time off that you had during that period. So how were you before you got the job at Owlis? How was that? So was it about a year that you had off, or was it less than that?
It must have seemed like that. Yeah, it was a long time.
Yeah,
and what I didn't really think about that. Not only did my girlfriend win, I think I was cooking for her a lot, and she definitely had breakfast, lunch and dinner cooked for her. So if there was competition for lockdown, I think she won.
Someone was happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also, like, I mean, going from that 100 miles an hour run in a kitchen to nothing, like, it's quite hard for a lot of chefs to do that, right? So I wanted to keep active. I wanted to, you know, keep myself busy, keep myself cooking as well, right? So I was baking a lot. I lived in a big block of flats at the time, so I was like baking bread for my neighbours and cookies and all that kind of stuff, so I didn't have to sort of leave the house too much and stuff.
Yeah.
And then started working with a bunch of guys called Hospitality for Heroes. So me and a bunch of other chefs were volunteering cooking for the NHS, basically. I think over the period of a few months, we cooked about 16,000 meals. It was just sort of three, four of us sort of smashing them out. So I think every day 300 meals will go to a different hospital, sort of dotted around London. So that was great to be a part of. It was sort of nice to sort of see, you know, be a part of like the whole sort of process of recovering and helping through London get, or even the UK get through what was happening at that time. And just, I mean, it was amazing to see the produce that was sort of donated to us, because everything was donated. Yeah. And the produce was just stunning. It was just sort of as good, if not better, than what you get in most restaurants. Obviously, restaurants were shut at the time as well, right? So instead of this, you know, produce being frozen so they can sell it at a later date, they just sort of, you know, cut their losses and donating it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was amazing. It's like one of the, I think the dairy we used to get was for a farm that normally produces dairy for the company Müller, the yogurt company, but they were taking 30% less dairy or something like that. So they were just sort of giving it all to us. And it's just like little things like that. It just sort of makes it so much easier for us to cook sort of generally like healthy nutrition but tasty meals for these guys at the time, because obviously they're way too busy to sort of, you know, help cook for themselves, or whether it'd be easier for them to eat on their break. But we even designed the meals that they could pack it up and take it home if they were too busy on shift to eat it on their shift as well. So
yeah, it was an amazing initiative during the pandemic. But yeah, so it was pretty amazing that, you know, considering we're in the middle of a pandemic, you got a job when most people are actually being, you know, fired left, right and center and out of jobs. You got yourself an amazing job at Owlis.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I feel lucky to be there as well. I think there's a few other chefs up for the job.
Yeah.
Feel lucky. So we're pretty much opened after the first sort of lockdown. Straight into cooking with Ollie on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And did they headhunt you, or did you apply?
No, I applied for it. Yeah, I applied for it. So sort of sent over my CV to Ollie, and Ollie was like, yeah, it's coming for a day. And I think with a place sort of like that, it's more like your personality, right? Like, yes, I worked in good restaurants and I've got a sort of bit of a different experience from most people like working in Japan. But I think it's just the fact that, you know, I can talk to a stranger and spark up a conversation with a guest, and which, yeah, I think a lot of chefs can struggle with that. A lot of chefs are so focused on their food, which is not a bad thing, but sort of, you know, the rest of it doesn't really come sort of too easily to people.
That's a tricky thing to do, because you know, your concentration levels, I've seen you do it. I mean, your plate up and how you guys put things together, it is a tricky thing. It's quite finicky. You've got lots of little detail in there, and then you're having full-blown conversations with people.
You gotta learn to multitask for sure. Yeah
big time. And I kept, you know, nudging my husband saying, just stop talking to him, he's gotta concentrate. But you make it so flawless.
It was a shaky start, but you do get used to it for sure. And it's just, I mean, you're just passionate about what you do as well, right? So it's easy to talk about it and it's easy to do it. As long as you're organized and you're prepped and you're ready for it, then the sort of that service, that last sort of 20% of the cooking that we do in service, you know, it should be easy.
Mm. And there's a lovely tribute story around how the restaurant was named Owlis. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't know all the details. It's a story that's been passed down to me, but as far as I'm aware, Owlis is the name of a gent who helped open Simon Longplume 20 years ago now. So we're going to celebrate Longplume's 20th birthday next year. So I think it was a huge part of the whole sort of farm to table. Obviously, it's Norwegian name, right? So it's a Norwegian gent. And it's sad, I think, as Simon opened up his restaurant, sadly, he passed. So sort of in homage to him, sort of named all his tasting menu restaurants after him, Owlis. Yeah, it's a nice touch for sure.
Yeah, it really is. And was the concept, was that, was it Owlis's concept? Was it in his mind to create an 8-seater sort of chef's table restaurant?
I'm not sure, to be honest. No, I'm not entirely sure. No, it's something you might have to ask Ollie or Simon. They can tell you about that. But I know it's something they've always wanted to have in the company. They've always wanted these sort of development kitchens, chef's table style kitchens. Mm. So yeah, if the first one wasn't next to Longplume, then that would have been in Claridge's next to Farah. And just sort of just a nice creative space for chefs to go in and just sort of create food that's, you know, just a bit different, maybe a bit quirky, but still delicious, still sort of very much focused on what's coming in on the farm. Because the farm's so small, the guys are doing a great job down there, but also it's quite hard for them to produce a lot of food because obviously supplying quite a few restaurants, Long Plume, Hemrock, Rogan & Co. So when you're supplying a small restaurant like Owlish, just eight colours, you know, it's a bit more freedom for the farmers to sort of, you know, test something out and grow something a bit different and a bit quirky and sort of send it to us instead of sort of growing a huge amount out of it and it not quite working or something like that. So it's cool to, yeah, I'm always on the phone and chatting to John, Farmer John, about what produce is coming through and, you know, what I can create and what dishes can we sort of get in the pipeline working and sort of trying to get them down and back on the menu. So
So Owlish is considered to be a mirror image of the development kitchen at two Michelin star Long Plume. Is that a fairer assessment to make?
Yeah, I think probably trying to move away from the whole development kitchen side of space in Soho anyway, in the London spot. Chef's Table, I think, is sort of the route we want to head down towards. Because yes, we're a small space, and yes, we are developing dishes all the time. But for me, it kind of sounds like we're using you guys as guinea pigs to sort of, you know, giving you dishes that aren't quite ready, aren't quite fixed. Everything I put on the menu, I think it's tried, tested, ready to go, you know, it's delicious. And also, like, my experience compared to Simon's experience, like, I shouldn't be developing dishes for him to put on the menu, right? It's he's far superior chef than I am. So it's just a nice space for us to sort of cook and just create that nice intimate environment as a chef's table, I think.
Yeah. And did you train at Long Plume for any period of time before
him? No. So I think typically the sort of roles in Owlish prior to me was sort of, you know, head chef, sous chef, or sort of chef role within Owlish. I think typically it was always sort of promoted within, because, you know, you understand that sort of Simon Rogan ethos and history and really like work close with everything on the farm and stuff. So I think I might have been the first one to sort of move away from that sort of employing from outside for that job role, which, you know, I'm super happy about. I'm happy they sort of trust me to sort of crack on and work down there in Owlish. I've not spent any time in the kitchen at Long Plume. Spent a bit of time on the farm, so sort of understand how John and the guys work up there. Spent a day or two in Hemrock, so sort of in a few of the other sites around Long Plume in the Lake District. But not actually been to Long. I've eaten in Long Plume, of course. Did my homework before I started working for the company. I did a bit of a recce, and then I ate in all the restaurants before I started working, just so I can get a bit of an understanding myself and understand the sort of style of food and the ethos and the direction that, you know, I think Simon wants the company and the restaurants to be moving towards.
And how involved are you in the menu that you serve? Is it, I know that you and Ollie work together on that. How much is your input in that menu?
So there's a few classic bites on the menu. I just, not only will I feel rude to take off, I just don't want to take them off. I think they're delicious. So I think we do a variation in across the board in most of the restaurants is the truffle pudding. It's a bit of a classic in the company, and it's just delicious. So I don't want to take it off the menu. But apart from that, it's quite nice that they sort of, again, trust me, let me sort of crack on and pretty much full free reign, as long as I keep within the style and in the ethos. And, you know, Ollie comes in and tastes the dishes and we tweak them together. Yeah, it's just so nice to sort of effectively treat it as if it's my own little restaurant, but in the sort of style and the way that Simon is, basically. But it's amazing to have someone like Ollie and to someone like Simon around you to, you know, point you in the right direction and say, like, don't you, let's try this way, let's try that way. Ollie will never say no. He'll just never say no, it's terrible. He'd always be like, try this way, or let's try that way, or it's just, yeah, he's a great mentor to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're both phenomenal chefs, as are you. So I'm amazed Owlish didn't have a Michelin star. How do you feel about that side of the business?
I mean, it's always a touchy subject, that one, I think. Obviously, I've worked in great restaurants, Michelin star, two Michelin star restaurants. I mean, at the end of the day, we've just got a fully booked restaurant now. cooking great food. Just generally love being there. I mean, if that happens, it happens. It's obviously a bit of a childhood dream of mine. I would love it to happen. But also there's more important things to worry about, right? To make sure the guests are happy and we're happy as well, cooking for the food. I think that's a big part of the thing. I think it's a thing that's kind of been lost in the industry a bit recently. Like, you need to enjoy your job, the amount of hours we work. So it's just create a great environment. So for people to work in, for people to visit, for people to eat. So for me, that's our focus this year. I think it's just sort of, you know, get our heads down and just sort of really just keep that going, because it's something that's always happened at Owlis, just that nice environment and like relax, and it's not a stuffy environment. You know, I say to people as they come in, you know, you're here to have a good time more than anything. You're not on your best behavior. So it's you go out to eat to enjoy yourself at the end of the day, really. So that, for me, that's the sort of direction that we're heading in at the moment. I mean, if it happens, it happens. That would be amazing. But yeah, don't attempt it.
Yeah, I really hope it does. I was, like I said, surprised that it hasn't happened. And the restaurant is just, the food is that you're serving up is just phenomenal. Absolutely beautiful. From the moment we stepped in the door, the whole experience was just really, really excellent. So what are your future plans? I mean, do you have a desire to open your own restaurant? Are you happy to stay with Simon for the future? What are your personal ambitions?
I mean, I think there's always the chef goal is to always have your own place and have your own restaurant. And it is mine at the moment, still is. I don't know if that's going to change in the future. I'm sure it will. Everybody's mind changes over time. I know it's something Ollie wanted to do when he first started working for the company, but now he's sort of found his own stride and he's built that relationship with Simon that, you know, he's trusted to open up restaurants and, you know, work abroad and help the company in lots of different spaces. But I think for me, it's still definitely end goal for me is to have, you know, not my name above the door, but definitely my own restaurant, right? So it's whether what country that would be in or what city that would be in, I don't know yet, but sort of want to learn as much as possible and sort of work my way through this company and build a great relationship with these guys in this company, because I'm relatively fresh to the company. I've been about 9-10 months now. And obviously a lot of that has been lockdown. So we're doing the Simon Rogan at home meals throughout lockdown, which kept us busy and kept us match fit, so to speak. But I think in the future, obviously, I don't know, it's hard to say, but I would definitely love my own restaurant at some point, for sure.
Yeah, so you mentioned possibly moving abroad. Is there a particular destination in mind that you'd be happy to go to?
Yeah, for sure. I really like the food scene in Singapore. I think that's really cool and pretty up and coming at the moment. And I think if I did open my own space and if it was there, I feel like my style of food would be quite popular there. Because obviously you've got to think of it from a business point of view as well, right? You can't open up a restaurant in a space where it won't be appreciated. Or even Sydney, maybe, potentially. I don't know. I've first time buyer, just bought my first place. So definitely in London for the next few years minimum. So, we'll see. For sure, I don't want to limit myself to one space as well, right? And I don't want to limit myself to one cuisine. Right. I think a lot of people can fall in the trap of just sort of cooking one food or one style of food. And like, I don't just want to cook Japanese food or sushi for the rest of my life, right? It's, I just want to cook food what I think is delicious and I think is tasty. So it's I'll keep it sort of quite vague and it'll just be my style of food, which is, I think some people, as I was saying, fall in the trap of just doing barbecue or just doing, you know, French food and stuff. And I think there's so many flavors out there and combinations and different techniques that you can use if you don't limit yourself to one style of cuisine, that you can sort of be a bit more broader and just achieve more flavor, basically.
Yeah. Something I ask all my guests is, tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
Okay, that's a hard one. that's not an easy one. I don't think a lot of people know. I came runner up in a competition called Sussex Young Chef. So it was when I was working at that restaurant, Seven Dials. I think I might have been at the past by then, actually, under Matt Gillen. I definitely was. And I wasn't quite good enough to win it. There was another guy from another Michelin style restaurant in the area who sort of just picked me to the post, I think. But yeah, that sort of, I don't know, it kind of put a dent in my confidence of cooking at that site at that stage. I think I was obviously working in a Michelin style restaurant. I was quite young, and when you're surrounded by great chefs that have done that competition before and won the competition, you know, you just kind of like, you feel a bit disheartened and just like, oh, like, didn't quite get it. I ran her up, yes, but, you know, still not quite winning it. I've not actually done any competitions since then, but it's definitely something I want to be looking at to do more in the future. Whether it's the Roos Scholarship or National Chef, or even like Great British Menu would be amazing. So it's definitely something I'll be looking at doing this year for sure.
Amazing. Well, that's quite exciting. So I look forward to seeing what comes up next. Charlie, thank you so much for your time. It's been awesome chatting with you and having some one-on-one time.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
And you guys, if you want to follow Charlie on Instagram, he's at CharlieTaylor92 and I'm at PoshNoshGal. I highly recommend you give Aulis a visit. It's a phenomenal restaurant and Charlie gives you so much time. It's a really, really stunning experience. And if you enjoyed today's interview, please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. It helps others find me.